Good. Well, welcome. You may be seated. Students are with us with a program called Court with Class. This is a national award-winning program that's sponsored by the State Bar and this court. We invite high school students across the state to join us for an oral argument. And if the students agree, then they are sent copies of the briefs in the cases that they are to hear. And part of the program, the court has a justice speak with the students and anyone else who wishes to come. And we talk about the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues in the case you're about to hear. Now, the marshal has a summary of the case that we are about to hear. If anyone would like a copy of that, just raise your right hand or left hand, and we'll give you a copy. Okay? We shall proceed then after I introduce the court to you. Starting on my far right is Justice Patience Rogensack. She is the justice with whom the Oconomowoc High School students will meet at noon. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her left is Justice David Prosser. And on the far left is Justice Lewis Butler. With all of those preliminaries completed, we will now hear 05AP0573-CR State v. Johnson. Representing the state of Wisconsin is Ms. Wellman, Sally Wellman.
Thank you, and may it please the court. I am Assistant Attorney General Sally Wellman representing the state, which is the petitioner in this court. We're here today to ask this court to reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals and to affirm the trial court order that denied Mr. Johnson's motion to suppress in the trial court. It appears that the law is not in dispute in this case, or the standards of review, but rather it's the application of the law to the facts of this case. Very briefly, I think we're in agreement that a lawful stop or roadside encounter, that during a lawful stop or roadside encounter, a police officer is permitted to do a protective search, a pat down of the person, and a protective search of the passenger compartment of a vehicle in the area in which a weapon may be placed or hidden, if he has a reasonable belief based on specific and articulable facts, which taken together with the rational inferences from those facts, reasonably warrant him in believing that his safety or the safety of others is in danger because the suspect may be armed with a weapon or may be harboring a weapon in the vehicle within reach. And this is based on Terry versus Ohio and Michigan versus Long, which have been followed by the Wisconsin courts from their inception. The standard is objective, that is what a reasonable man under the circumstances would be warranted in the belief that his safety or that of others is in danger. But the court looks at the totality of all of the circumstances. And the ultimate question of whether the police had reasonable suspicion to do a protective search is a question of law that this court will determine de novo. And the Court of Appeals determined de novo, but held that the officers did not have reasonable suspicion to do a protective search of the car. We believe that the Court of Appeals erred in reaching that conclusion, and that in this case, the officers had reasonable suspicion to do a protective search of both Johnson's person and the passenger compartment of the car he was driving, because they pulled him over for what might be termed a routine traffic stop. They pulled him over for an emissions suspension and because he failed to signal a turn. They were in a marked squad car. They used both their siren and lights to pull him over. He did pull over promptly, and it was about Well, it was late afternoon on November 5th, which in Wisconsin, it was dark out, but there were streetlights illuminating so they could see.
Can I just ask a question? Mm-hmm. Apparently, they must have pulled him over because he didn't signal, because you wouldn't just pull somebody over for an admission suspension. How would you know that?
Well, apparently, the plates, the DOT records that they can run a search of, show that the plates are suspended because of an emissions violation.
Well, why would they run on the plates? Yes, why would you run something on the plates if there are headlights out, they're speeding?
That was my question.
I guess I didn't understand. Yeah. They had stopped this car previously, and I think, if I recall right, a couple of days, or if they did it like on a Friday, and then they had their weekend, right. And these same two officers saw the same car. And they didn't give, when they stopped it the first time, and Mr. Hicks was driving, and he was not the owner of the car, and they explained in that situation they generally don't give a ticket for the emission suspension because it's not the owner who is responsible for getting it fixed. So when they saw it this time, they pulled it over and, you know, they didn't know, of course, whether it would be the owner who was
Why'd they stop it the first time?
I'm not sure that that's in the record. I don't recall it being stated. It turned out that Mr. Hicks did get a ticket because he was driving after revocation.
Well, Ms. Wellman, let me ask you a follow-up on Justice Wilcox's question. We know that there's a failure to signal turn. We know that there's an emission suspension. And as I understand the facts, the individual then showed the officer that the emissions had been taken care of, so the suspension is left. So all you have left, as I understand it, is the failure to signal turn. I was curious. I didn't see either brief really argue the import of Knowles versus Iowa in a unanimous opinion from the U.S. Supreme Court and how that impacts on this case, dealing with, as you called it, a routine traffic stop. When the purposes of the stop are over, doesn't that end the search? That was also a case where there was a protective search done, and I believe Justice Rehnquist's opinion said you had to let them go when the purpose of the traffic stop was over. It doesn't have impact on this case?
Well, I have to, the case sounds familiar, but it's not ringing any real loud bells. It's ringing a very vague bell. But the argument was not made here at any time by the defense in the Court of Appeals or the trial court that the purpose for the stop was over. Officer Stillman did testify that, well, let's just back up, make sure that we're all on the same page, and that after, when I just said that it was dark out but they could see inside the car, both officers testified to seeing the driver bend or lean forward as if reaching under the seat of his car. One of the officers said his head and shoulders nearly disappeared. The other one described it as disappearing. So they were concerned that he may be stashing a weapon or grabbing a weapon from under the seat of the car. So, and we'll get into the reasons why that's important later. Officer Stillman testified that they then both walked up to the car. He went to the driver's side. Officer Doomers went to the passenger side. There was one passenger in the car. Officer Stillman said he told Mr. Johnson why they stopped him for the emissions violation, and he showed him paperwork. The way the officer testifies is he says, he showed me paperwork showing that it had been taken care of, in essence. I can't tell from that testimony where the officer is saying that he believed based on that paperwork or that the driver was showing him that, either saying it or representing that. In any event, they then did ask him to step out and do a pat-down. Now, Officer Doomer's recollection was that the paperwork wasn't shown until after they had tried to pat Mr. Johnson down, and he had fallen down whenever they reached near the left pants pocket, and then they sat him down on the curb. Officer Doomer stood behind him and told him to keep his hands away from his body while Officer Stillman searched the car, and Officer Doomer testifies that at that point, sometime in that point, he started talking about having the admission papers and then told Officer Stillman where it was, and he went and got it out of the glove box.
What was the basis for the pat-down then? Was it basically the head and shoulder bob?
It was seeing him reach what they believed was under the seat of the car.
Well, I want to be careful about this. I don't believe the transcripts indicated that they saw him reach under the car. My understanding of the testimony was that the head and shoulders moved forward and then moved back.
As if he was reaching under the seat of the car. Right.
That's the conclusion. I'm looking at the factual basis. So
right,
the articulable fact was that the head and shoulders moved forward and moved backwards.
Disappear. One of them described it as disappearing. And then their inference from that was it was as if he were reaching under the car. And their further inference from that, that he could be either reaching to grab or stashing a weapon.
Were there any other facts that justified the pat-down or the protective search of the vehicle? Or is that essentially what this case is about?
Well, the additional facts, there are no additional facts in terms of knowing anything about him personally. They did not know the driver. They didn't know anything about him. Our interpretation of that is that, therefore, they had no reason not to. They had no reason not to be concerned. For example, they didn't know him and know that he did not carry a weapon or was not likely to have a weapon.
Isn't that a glass half empty interpretation?
Well, we see it as at worst neutral in that it doesn't add anything in particular, but it doesn't dispel the reasonable suspicion they had based on the movement that they saw and the concern that they had.
As I recall the testimony, and I can't remember if it was Officer Dummer or Officer Stillman or both, but at least one of them testified that it was this movement of the head and shoulders which was the basis for the search of the car. I mean, and the only basis. Is that your understanding?
Well, he was asked why did, I can't remember exactly what the question was, but in essence, why did you pat him down or what did you do next and why? And he said, we asked him to get out of the car. We wanted to pat him down because of what we had seen, because in their training and experience, a person in a car can easily be reaching for or hiding contraband or a weapon under the seat of the car, and then it's an easy access, and they wanted to ensure their own safety.
I want to go back a little bit on the record of events. In your own brief, you indicate that the paperwork in response to the question was shown before the defendant was asked to leave the car.
That's what Officer Stillman testified to, and those are the facts that we used in our brief.
Okay. Well, then why would the officer ask the person to get out of the car?
Well, I have two responses to that. First of all, the fact that he showed him the paperwork doesn't necessarily mean that the officers don't have the opportunity to do some further checking. And, in fact, Officer Dumas did indicate, and he didn't indicate exactly at what point in time they did it, but he said, once we checked with dispatch to see if that meant that this really was cleared, because their DOT indicators records were telling them that it was not yet cleared. And apparently dispatch said, well, with the paperwork, it probably is. Apparently there's a time lag between the time that the getting the suspension checked and approved, or getting the emissions checked and approved, and then it gets into the DOT records. So at some point they did, you know, at least talk to dispatch about it. But I think that once they've stopped him, even though they stopped him for the emissions violation suspension and the failure to signal a turn, they weren't done. I mean, they still had a right, and they hadn't done it at that point, but they still had the right to ask him for his license, to run a license check and a warrants check. They ended up not giving him a ticket for the failure to signal, but they certainly could have yet. So just because he handed them some papers that you look at the face and says, you know, they tested out and it was okay in October, you have DOT saying he's still not cleared, the plates are still suspended, it's not over. The police don't have to just say, well, this stop is ended because you showed us some paperwork. They can still continue to check it out, and they did apparently check it out with dispatch at some point.
My recollection, and I could be wrong on this, so correct me if I'm wrong as well, but from my days in municipal court, my recollection was that it generally can take up to a month, sometimes 2 months, for a DOT computer to catch up with what happened on the street, and that the statute provides that if the person provides the paperwork, that that is sufficient. Am I in error on that?
I'm not aware of that statute, and no one cited it below or in the briefs. You may be correct. I don't know.
Would that matter to you, to your argument?
No, I don't think it would, unless we want to back all the way up and start the case all over again, because in the trial court, the defendant was challenging the stop, but in the Court of Appeals, he was only challenging the protective search of the car. So
regardless of your position is, even if they satisfied themselves that they're, that he wasn't in violation of the emission standards, even if they satisfied themselves they were not going to give him a ticket for failing to signal, they had the right before they released him to do a Terry search, a protective search.
They did in this case, yes, because of what they had seen, and that gave them reasonable suspicion. Just because the immediate reason for the stop may have been satisfied to their belief that, you know, we don't need to give him a ticket for this, they still have the safety concern. I mean, that's what Terry is all about. What? If they had a reasonable suspicion that he may have armed himself with a weapon when he reached under the seat, gotten a weapon, or he might still have a weapon under the car, they don't have to let him just drive away. They can check that out first for their own safety.
My impression is, correct me if I'm wrong, that officers don't want the driver to get out of the car most of the time. Now here, they directed the driver to get out of the car after being shown paperwork. It seemed to me, what would the motivation be, even if the person had had a gun on him? What would the motivation be if you've already been excused from the violation, in effect?
Well, he hadn't been excused because they had not resolved whether the paperwork trumped the DOT records. And the trial court, in fact, found, although no one cited him as statute, the trial court found that the police were entitled to rely on the DOT computer, which told them that he was still suspended. So they hadn't really resolved that. But I think the police do have the right, if they have reasonable suspicion, which of course is the if in this case, but if they have reasonable suspicion to believe he may be armed or have a weapon in the car, they have the prerogative to ask him to get out and pat him down, because as long as he has access to that weapon, he presents a danger. Just because they say, okay, you can go on your way, he may drive 2 feet and turn around and shoot them. I mean, he may have some reason to be violent that they have a right to protect themselves against. And that's the whole purpose of doing a pat-down. I mean, the person in Terry could have just, the officer could have just let the men go on, even though it appeared that they were trying to case the store for a daytime robbery. He didn't have to intervene at that point. A crime had not yet been committed. They're not required to let that happen.
Ms. Wellman, my understanding is that when the trial court judge, Judge Torhorst, looked at this case, he decided on the basis of consent. He claimed that there had been consent by Johnson. You're not pursuing that, is that correct?
We are not pursuing that. In the trial court, the defendant's motion, was very perfunctory. And, in fact, the first time it just said, well, there was no warrant and no probable cause and everything violated the Fourth Amendment. And the state moved to make it more particular. And then he added a sentence saying, well, they didn't have, their stop was illegal because the car was validly registered and there was no consent. So going into the suppression hearing, that was what the claims appeared to be. Most of the argument to the trial court focused on this question of whether they had a right to stop the vehicle for the emissions violation, even though it turned out that that had been, that the vehicle was no longer suspended at that time. That's when the trial court made its ruling that, yes, they could stop it because they have a right to go by the DOT computers. The court also found consent to search, and we agree that there was at best acquiescence here. and that was not consent. The trial court didn't resolve any of the issues about the protective search, and defense counsel not only didn't challenge the pat-down of Johnson's person, but he specifically said, we agree the police had the right to do a pat-down of his person based on what they testified they saw. It was a reasonable Terry pat-down. His position was that a reasonable Terry pat-down of a driver of a vehicle doesn't give the police the authority to search the vehicle. And that's just absolutely wrong under Michigan versus Long. So
why is it that the Department of Justice is able to take what is arguably a finding of fact and say, we don't believe that anymore. We just abandon the court's finding.
Oh, you mean on the consent?
Yeah.
Oh, we believe that it doesn't meet the standard for what a consent has to be, that mere acquiescence in that situation isn't sufficient, my understanding.
But by doing that, haven't you really deprived the trial court of the ability to analyze and opine on the philosophy that you are now presenting to the court?
I don't know how we reached the decision in this particular case because I wasn't involved then. But if you look at the record below, consent wasn't exact. I don't know how to say this. It was talked about, but it wasn't really argued. For example, the police officer said he consented. And then when asked further questions, he says, well, what the officer did is says, well, I'm going to search you. And then he said, I'm going to search the car. And he didn't object. He didn't say anything in response to that, like, no, I don't want you to. The trial court then just said he gave consent. But nobody argued the legal cases about what it takes to be consent. So I'm not sure that the trial court really focused on that issue either. Really, the omissions violation suspension and the discrepancy between DOT time lag was the issue in the trial court. But be that as it may, we did choose not to proceed on that basis in the Court of Appeals brief, and that issue has dropped out at this point.
Well, can this court say, look at the record and say it's consent, and say, look, whether consent was given is a legal question, and we can look at the record anew and say it was consent. And we can cite Kleinmeier's previous case and say it's implied consent, that implied consent is not acquiescence. You're saying it is acquiescence, that acquiescence and consent are different. That case looks to me like it says, hey, she kept quiet, she knew, she called the cops, that's implied. And I suppose if he were here, we'd have a little debate about what's acquiescence and what's implied consent. So is that question of consent before us in court?
Well, it certainly hasn't been briefed. Obviously, you know, we could brief it. I just want to check our footnote.
It's in the Court of Appeals decision in a footnote.
Right. And
if my recollection is right.
And in the text, too.
Right. And in our brief in the Court of Appeals, which I assume you have on page 6, let's see. We concede on appeal that Johnson did not consent. And then we say, the state acknowledges that in so conceding, the state is departing from the circuit court's finding that the officer obtained Johnson's consent. And then we just say that we do it mindful that you can support on any ground. I was thinking that this footnote that we had said that the reason we did that was the acquiescence theory. I may be wrong on that. I thought our brief said why we were not arguing that, and it doesn't. I don't think the facts on, quote, consent are in dispute in this record. Mr. Johnson didn't testify. You have the officer's testimony.
So what you're really looking at is the application of a legal principle to the facts, which is a question of law.
I think so.
Do you think it's helpful to an appellate court for the state to concede on the application of legal principles to facts rather than arguing what there is to argue and letting opposing counsel do the same thing and having the court make up its mind?
Well, I think if we feel that there is no merit to the position, then we feel that we have an obligation not to argue that position. As I said, I wasn't involved in this particular decision, but in decisions that I have been involved in where we elect not to make an argument in support of something the trial court has done, that, you know, that is the consideration, that if we feel it has no merit, or either the prosecutor or the court was just wrong on the law, then we don't pursue it. I'm assuming that that was the situation here.
So you think there's no merit to the argument that this could be interpreted as consent under these facts?
Yeah, I'm just not familiar enough with the consent doctrine or the reasoning behind this particular case to know. I'd be certainly happy to brief that issue.
At least someone at some time in your office felt that.
That decision was made, yes.
And that's an issue of competency of counsel and frivolous claims or defense. I haven't looked to see whether it covers criminal cases, but the essence of it.
I'm assuming that that's what the reason that we didn't challenge
that's
that.
That's your position of argument. Why you would concede an argument.
Right. If this court thinks that, you know, we should brief it, of course we'd be, you know, happy to brief it.
Ms. Wellman, I've got another question, and I'm not trying to put you or opposing counsel on the spot, but I was a little bit surprised that I didn't see in the briefs on either side any reference to the case of State versus Williams. That's a case that also involves a furtive action by the defendant. And I'm just wondering if there was a conscious decision made not to utilize that case, or did I miss it and it's in the briefs? Or are you not familiar with it?
No, I am familiar with it, and I was thinking, I know I read it and before oral argument, and I was thinking that one of the reasons I read it was because it was cited by one of the parties or by the Court of Appeals, but I could be wrong about that.
I know it ended up in my bench memo, but that's not necessarily the authority we can use.
You know, we certainly think that the reaching movement and the inference, as if I'm recalling the correct case, it's the one where the driver was reaching down behind the passenger seat
exactly.
After he was stopped. Now, in that case, there are other factors that were relied on, such as that the stop itself was based on an anonymous tip about drugs. Which is, of course, different from our case. But I think it is helpful to the state in the sense that the court did not seem to be willing to draw the inference or to accept the inference drawn by the officers that when the defendant was reaching behind and they couldn't see what he was doing with his hand because he was reaching now down behind a seat, like reaching under a car seat, it's reasonable to draw the inference that there may be a weapon there. Of course, there may not be a weapon. It's ambiguous. We agree with that. That's what Terry allows for the protection of the officers, is to resolve ambiguous, potentially dangerous situations.
But isn't the distinction with Williams the fact that in having an anonymous tip about drug dealing, and I know this Court's view in the past, and I think the same for the United States Supreme Court, is drug dealers often carry with them weapons. It adds that inference that you already have a reasonable suspicion that the person may be armed and dangerous. That, coupled with the fact of the furtive movement, gives rise for the basis for the stop. And as I understand your argument in this case, the only facts that we're really looking at, since we're dealing with a traffic stop, is the movement alone.
It is the only fact that we have in the sense that we don't have something additional like a drug tip, or knowing what kind of neighborhood it was. I hesitate to say it's the only fact in the sense that we still look at all of the circumstances, including the context. And I do think it's important that one of those contextual circumstances here is that they saw him do this immediately after he'd been pulled over by the police with lights and siren flashing. He knew it was the police. I think most reasonable drivers would expect the officer will come up to your car door and window. Therefore, he will see what he sees in your lap or in the car. And in that brief interval between stopping and before the officer gets to the car, he makes a movement as if he's reaching under the seat. And we believe it's reasonable for the police to have a reasonable suspicion, at least, that it may be because he's grabbing or stashing a weapon. And If that's what it is, then of course it's dangerous, and of course they have a right to protect themselves. So only the caveat is the only one that within that context, and that they did not know him, so they did not know that they need not fear him. I see my red light is on. It probably has been for some time. So,
thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Attorney Eileen A. Hirsch, Assistant State Public Defender, representing Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think I'll just start with a few of the factual questions the Court raised, because I think that the Court is interested in those. With regard to the consent issue, I can tell you that I did raise it in my brief in the Court of Appeals. It's thoroughly briefed there, so if you go back to it, I would ask you to read my brief before you make a decision on that issue. With regard to the information about the registration suspension, Officer Stillman testified that he learned about it on November 2nd when he stopped Mr. Hicks with Mr. Johnson's car. Mr. Hicks then testified that he had showed Officer Stillman that he had passed the registration, the car had passed the registration, the emissions test. There was a conflict in testimony about that. The Court resolved it in favor of the officer. And so we have not gone back to the issue about the grounds for the stop, because that's a fact finding by the Court that we respect. I think with regard to Ms. Wellman said that she didn't think that there was any note in the record that the officer was satisfied when he received this piece of paper from Mr. Johnson. And I would refer the Court to their Appendix 144. And what he said at that point is he showed me adequate paperwork saying that the vehicle has passed emissions within the past couple days, so that those circumstances were cleared up. I think that's the officer's acceptance that this is valid. They did, as Ms. Wellman said, go back and check with dispatch. They agreed. Later in the
Let me just pause you there, Ms. Hirsch. They still had the basis of the failure to signal turn. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor, and that's why I did not raise Knowles versus Iowa, because I decided that the trial court found that they still had that right turn signal violation.
But I want to ask you about that, because as I understood Knowles, and correct me if I'm wrong, Knowles would have given the officer the ability to go ahead and finish whatever was necessary with respect to the failure to signal turn violation. But that was not a criminal charge, that was a minor traffic violation. And that upon completion of whatever you have to do with failure to signal turn, then the officer would have to then let him go on his way without a search. That was what I thought the import of Knowles was, so I was surprised that you didn't include it in your brief.
Well, I think that Michigan versus Long stands for the general proposition that until that's resolved, if the officers have a reasonable suspicion that their safety is endangered because this person is dangerous, they may have access to a weapon, until that's resolved, that they can do that, that they can search or frisk the person in the car. And I didn't think the record clearly established that that had been resolved.
Well, the failure to signal turn hadn't been resolved, but it's the reasonable suspicion that the person may be armed and dangerous that it's an issue here, is it not?
That's correct. That's very correct. And I actually want to come to that. I just wanted to deal with a couple of those factual issues. But I really want to come to that, because I think that it is true, as Justice Bradley said, this is a glass half full, and Ms. Wellman responded that, they didn't have any reason to believe he was not dangerous. And I think that really puts Fourth Amendment analysis on its head. This was a non-warrant search, and therefore the burden is on the state to show a reasonable suspicion that he's armed and dangerous. What they had here was that, based on their training and experience, it's clear from our cases that officers are trained to be careful when the suspect's hands aren't showing. There's a movement where their hands aren't showing. Actually, Matechka, which is cited in the state's brief, the officer had that circumstance. He said, I pulled over this van for speeding. He reached down and to the right, and I had a heightened awareness. I think that's what police officers have. And I think in the Terry analysis, that is an inchoate and unparticularized suspicion. It's a general rule. In a traffic stop, if somebody moves in a way that you can't see their hands, then you have a heightened awareness. You have this inchoate, non-particular suspicion. And what you have to do with that under the Terry analysis is examine that in the facts of this case and say, in this case, is that general suspicion that I've been trained to have, does it apply here? And I think when you do that in this case, it completely falls away. We have an admission suspension. It's cleared up. He cooperates with police by pulling over immediately. He maybe this right turn signal, although there's an interesting little twist in that, that it's not ever clear that the main officer, Stillman, ever knew about the right turn signal violation. And that's it. That's all they have. They've got a daytime stop on a city street. The officers aren't outnumbered by the passengers. And so when you look at that, how can you think that this movement means that this guy who has gone out and cleared up his admission suspension is armed and dangerous? There's just no context for it.
So what type of furtive movement would you need to make a stop?
To make,
none? In other words,
to make a frisk?
To make a frisk, right. I'm sorry. Yeah.
If you're asking the question that the state raised in its initial brief, is there any furtive movement that by itself, without any other circumstances, is sufficient to allow a frisk?
This was, in other words, this was the movement came after they were aware of the police. So they,
yes.
Okay, so this is, I wouldn't say typical, but it's typical of the, this is what the police are trained to look for. So they saw that. Now, you heard the argument or the discussion of my colleagues, whether they should have just let the person go. Could he have, opposing counsel said, well, they could have had a weapon, and they could have. So if there was no movement, in other words, nothing like that, if you put your arms over your head or, oh, like this, oh my God, the police or whatever. But this wasn't, this was the defined movement that they looked for, described either disappearing all the way so they couldn't see him or at least there was the bending down. So my question is, you think after that movement that wasn't enough? They had,
I think exactly what the officers testified. They did not know what he did with his hands. It was a movement that was enough to make them ask a question. It was not one that established a reasonable suspicion that the thing he did when he leaned over was hide a weapon, pull up a weapon, or do something with a weapon. Mm-hmm. That's what I think. And I think there has to be another step before you have to evaluate that movement in the circumstances to decide if it's more likely that this has to do with a weapon than it has to do with retrieving your wallet to show the police your driver's license or putting away the McDonald's wrappers that are on your floor.
So what should the officer have done? They had to evaluate. What is the next step?
Well, the next step really, actually Matechka sets this up. I think the officer in Matechka said, he had heightened awareness, so he did ask that driver to get out of the car so he could see his hands, which makes it a little bit unusual, but that's what he did in Matechka. And he asked him. He said, what were you reaching for under the seat? And it could be that if he had asked him, Mr. Johnson would have said, I was getting my wallet. Remember, I had my wallet on my lap when you asked me for my driver's license? I'd just gotten it out from under the seat. But this officer took that generalized, inchoate suspicion and applied it to Mr. Johnson without any questions and without any review of that suspicion in the context of the case.
Well, they say, and I'm just reading on the petition's appendix 124, Officer Stillman had Johnson exit the back of the vehicle and informed him. Why was that? Why was he having him exit the vehicle? And the question was, why was that? Answer, due to the movements, the suspicious movements that we both observed. It was for the officer's safety, not knowing that maybe he was reaching for either to grab or put down, thinking it possibly be a weapon that could injure us. We had him exit from the vehicle so we could see Mr. Johnson's movements, hands. Isn't this, you just talked about Matechka, isn't this anything on his possession at that time? Okay.
But that's, I think, I mean, the question wasn't asked in this case, but the Supreme Court has made a distinction between the infringement on liberty of being asked to get out of the car, being asked questions, and the infringement on liberty of being frisked. And they've said those are different things. The infringement on your liberty of being frisked is much greater than just being asked to get out of the car. And so if I hate to make a concession that I might have to give up in another case, but at this point, I think this is probably valid to get him out of the car. The question is, at that point, how do you weigh the liberty interests? And to me, Terry versus Ohio does that. And it says you can't do it on an unparticularized, inchoate suspicion. You have to particularize it to the facts. And if you read the state's brief, I noted this at page 2 of the reply brief. The state says this is that movement alone created reasonable suspicion because traffic stops in general are dangerous. So there's nothing particularized about this case.
Well,
does it rise from an unparticularized suspicion to a reasonable suspicion in Mr. Johnson's case? It's Mr. Johnson.
Yeah, and isn't that what they're talking about? They're talking about why did you do it? Well, because of what we observed. So they're talking about Mr. Johnson. That's why I'm just asking that.
What is it about that movement that makes them think they don't know what he did with his hands?
Right.
So what makes them think that's a weapon, which is the standard under Terry, as opposed to
contraband?
Well,
they were thinking it possibly. That's all. I'm just reading from the record. Right. That's what I was reading.
But I think to infringe on that liberty, you need more. And I would point out, by the way, this is Officer Dahmer's testimony you just read from, I think. And he also says again about just pat down for weapons, just for our safety. He uses that phrase twice there. And I went back and did look at Wisconsin cases, and Justice Crooks, I think you're right. We should have talked about Williams. I read it before the argument, too. But actually, the Moore case, M-O-H-R, talks a little bit about this. In that case, the officer repeatedly referred to his safety. We did this for officer safety. We did this for officer safety. And the Court of Appeals decided in that case, they said, there's nothing in this that makes it a reasonable, particularized suspicion about this guy. It's more of a general preventive measure. And I think that's what's working here. It's a general preventive measure rather than a reasonable suspicion particular to Mr. Johnson.
And I guess you've answered my question because I was trying to distinguish between someone that does nothing, except you have a traffic stop, you look in the car, and then based on what there was no furtive movement, there was no bending down, nothing done. Clearly there, nothing could be done. What you say have to go beyond, even if there is movement, there has to be one other step.
Correct. And I say that because the officer actually defined furtive movement in this case, Officer Stillman did, as not knowing what he was doing. Not knowing, I would say to you, this is Officer Dummer's testimony you just read to me, but Officer Stillman specifically said, a furtive movement means not knowing what he was doing. It's at page 154 of the appendix. Not knowing what he's going for is what he said.
But, Counselor, haven't we held many times that reasonable suspicion can be supported by acts which could be lawful?
Yes, of course. But you have to consider those acts in the context to decide whether it's likely to be, in this case, a reasonable suspicion he's armed and dangerous or not. And I also want to mention, by the way, when we get to I think we should talk about where Wisconsin cases go, and Williams certainly fits in that. When I look at this court's decision in the last, I think, 5 years, I start with in year 2000, you have McGill and you have Moore. And the facts, I put these cases on a continuum when I was thinking about them. I have Williams, McGill, Moore, Kyles, and then Johnson. Those are my cases that I looked at from this court. Williams was a drug crime. The court specifically talked about there was a report of a drug crime, and the court specifically discussed in that case that drugs are often linked to guns. We don't have that. There were no plates on the car, suggesting perhaps an attempt not to be caught. And he reached behind the passenger seat. In McGill, we have a traffic. McGill, Moore, and Kyles all involve traffic violations, something like these. All three of those are nighttime cases. This is a daytime case. And all three of them have McGill has a multitude of issues. It's got a lone officer at night. The guy doesn't pull over. He's very nervous. He's got the odor of intoxicants and drugs and puts his hands in his pockets. So I think if you look at the continuum of dangerousness, you've got Williams, and then you've got McGill, and then you go to Moore, where you have a 2 a.m. traffic violation. He's a passenger, hands in pockets. He resists the police officer's attempts to get him to go into the car, and he's very nervous. I think that comes next. And then you look at Kyles from 2004, traffic violation, passenger, 9 o'clock, fluffy coat, and he repeatedly put his hands in his pockets contrary to the police officer's directions. You put this case on that continuum, and I think that's what this court has to remember, is that these are fact-specific cases. I know you remember this. These are fact-specific cases, and you have to think, what does this tell police officers? What are we showing them? This case, I think, is way over on the other side of Kyle's. We have a daytime stop, no history. We've cleared up the major reason for the stop, and all we have is one motion, nothing else. And that motion could be innocent, it could be going for a weapon, but we have to weigh that motion in the context of the circumstances of the case to make that reasonable assumption. And I think in this case the state has simply failed to carry its burden of showing that this was a reasonable assumption, a suspicion of risk, based on Mr. Johnson's personal characteristics and the characteristics of this stop. I think I don't have anything else unless the court has more questions.
Any questions? Let's just look at consent for a minute. I don't have the Court of Appeals with me. I left it in the office. The Court of Appeals briefed. Was it briefed in by the state?
Oh, I briefed it. I filed the appeal. Right. I can never remember what that makes me.
A loser in the trial court.
On the wrong grounds, in my view. I did brief it, and I just said the trial court's factual finding was clearly erroneous. And what happened in that is that Officer Dummer first testified. He said Officer Stillman advised that he was going to search the vehicle. Mr. Johnson didn't have a problem with that, gave consent. That was Officer Dummer's testimony. And then on cross-exam, they came back to that, and he said, well, actually, Officer Stillman advised Mr. Johnson, due to his movements, that we were going to search the vehicle. So that became his testimony. And then he said, at that time, Mr. Johnson said, I don't have a problem with that. Now, you have to remember, Mr. Johnson has already been frisked, and he's sitting on the curb, and they've gotten the passenger out of the car and frisked him. So I don't know if he's really in a position to start to raise an objection to the consent to the search at that point. But he did not testify that he got consent. And then Officer Stillman came back and said, I don't remember asking him, and I don't see in the report if I asked him for consent. And then I brief it on acquiescence and authority. And I think, honestly, the state was right to concede this issue. As I told people about this case, I said, the judge just made a mistake.
And the next line after you, when he says, I don't remember asking him, and I don't see in the report that I asked him for consent, question. And that obviously is something that's important. You probably would have noted it in your report. Is that correct?
Yes. I think and the trial judge in this case wrote a written decision, and he was focused really on the issue of the stop and whether the police could rely on the DOT records. And I think that he really just misremembered the testimony or had notes that I really believe in this case that the trial court didn't make a reasoned legal decision about that he just made a mistake. It was a decision issued somewhat later. I have to point out, too, that actually later in this transcript it comes up that Mr. Johnson had actually passed an admissions test on October 3rd, a full month before he was stopped for this violation. So there certainly is a gap between DOT and what really happens. And I also am not aware, and I wish, if it's true, I wish I'd found it, a statute saying that that they can't rely on the DOT computer records because.
Well, no, I don't think the statute says. If my recollection is correct, that's not that the statute doesn't say that. I think at the point when the person shows that they have justifiably taken care of it, and I just don't recall whether that was the based on a statute or court practice, but my recollection was that was the end of it once you showed. But there certainly would be a valid basis for the stop and for the officer to check it out. I don't think there's any question of that.
Right, and there's no question. Nobody questioned the validity of this document in this case. I think it's just a delay in DOT.
Your position, I gather, is that even if they had settled out on the turn signal problem and they had settled out on the emission, if they had reasonable suspicion that he was armed, they could pat him down.
Not after they settled out. I mean, I think that there's...
Yeah, that's what I'm asking.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't take the position that after, you know, that they finished the stop and they said, okay, we accept your emission suspension document and we're just going to give you a warning on the turn signal, your driver's license checks out, now you're free to go, then they can't go search at that point.
Unless they get consent.
Pardon?
Unless they get consent.
Unless they get consent, and then there's an issue about extending the stop. But I thought on this record that I couldn't make a reasonable argument that the stop had ended.
Okay.
And that's why I didn't bring the Knowles versus Iowa
decision.
Counselor, I have one question about the facts, and it was something that Attorney Wellman brought up, at least first to my attention during oral argument. She said that there is some of the testimony in the record that one of the officers said the papers were not given until after he was out of the car, and then he said they're in the glove box, and one of the officers went and got them. Do you recall that also? And if you do, did the trial court do anything with that or make a finding showing he would accept one or the other officer's statement?
I do recall that. I footnoted it in my original brief in the Court of Appeals, and the trial court did not resolve it,
okay,
is the bottom line. The state then, in its brief, accepted Officer Stillman's. Officer Stillman was the lead officer here, and he's the one who actually got him out and did the search and everything. The state accepted his version of the facts, and I think really it's a distinction without a difference legally. I haven't pursued that issue because regardless of when it happened before they did the frisk of the car. So even if it was, as Officer Dummer testified, after they frisked him, sat him down on the curb, got the passenger out, then what Officer Dummer said is that Stillman then went to the glove box and got the registration, and then he frisked the car. So I came to think in the end that when it happened didn't really matter legally as to the grounds to search the car part at that point.
Okay. And so you don't agree with opposing counsel's argument that under U.S. Supreme Court law, if there was grounds to search him personally, that continues to the car with nothing else having to happen?
I do. I have come to believe, and I should have pointed that out and explained that to the court, I have come to believe that the crucial point is when they began the frisk of his person. And that was why we've just talked about the circumstances at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But there's obviously talk in these briefs about when they do the frisk of his person, he had a bad leg, he had been shot in the leg evidently, and he fell down. I don't think that can add to reasonable suspicion because I think that's fruits of an illegal search, of an illegal Terry frisk. So I don't think it can. I do think there's a possibility. For example, if Johnson's sitting on the curb and they go to get the passenger out and he yells at the passenger, grab the gun, you know, clearly...
He might have reasonable suspicion.
Clearly reasonable suspicion can change over the course of a stop. I mean, it can either go up or go down. But I don't think that the particular act of him falling down while they were frisking him can add because I think the original frisk was unconstitutional. I do think that's a crucial point, and I don't think you can use the fruit of the unconstitutional search.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from the court?
Thank you, Ms. Hirsch. Ms. Wellman?
I just want to reiterate the point that I think it is very telling that Officer Stillman described what was concerning to them about seeing this movement that the driver made as if he were reaching under the seat. We don't know what he's going for. That's exactly why they have to have the ability to protect themselves by doing a somewhat invasive but admittedly limited pat down of the outer clothing for weapons and search of the passenger compartment of the car where the weapon might be.
Ms. Wellman, let me press you on that. I just we often bring our own experiences here, and I think that oftentimes, I know as a driver of a vehicle, I might put my wallet in the glove box. It's because it's bulky to have on your person. You don't like to leave it sitting out in the open. Now, obviously, if I'm pulled over and I reach over and I reach and open that glove box and take something out, the officer may not be able to see what's in my hands, but they can see the movement of going into a closed glove box and coming back. Now, the officer's not going to know what I have either. And I think that's true of many drivers. So my concern about the argument that you make is that without another step that leads to suspicion of armed and dangerous, the step that you had in the Williams case, if that step is not there, basically this can be a basis for almost any driver who's on the road at any time to be frisked. And that concerns me about the state's argument.
I can understand your concern, but I think the concern for the officer has to outweigh the balance in this case, because if the person is reaching for a weapon instead of just their wallet or instead of just putting a McDonald's bag away, that situation is so dangerous to the officer and anyone around.
Is he reaching for a weapon or putting a weapon, hiding a weapon?
Either way, because especially in this situation where he's just been stopped for a traffic violation, he's going to be able to go on his way most likely. So he will have immediate access to that weapon again. And for whatever reasons that are not understandable to most of us, some people, even though the stop may be over and they're free to go, will still use a weapon against police.
But the part that's missing, and that this is the part that concerns me, is that in the actions that I described, or other drivers may have, there's nothing specific to indicate that that person, that nothing specific or articulable to indicate that that person may be armed or dangerous. It's just the generalized, as Ms. Hirsch has argued, the generalized suspicion, well, anybody could be armed and dangerous in that situation. Don't you need, under the case law, something that really links it into this individual for this particular stop?
Yes, and that something is his conduct. Just as it, his conduct in some situations of reaching into his pockets. Now, in Kyle's, partly I think because of the extremely short duration, 48 seconds, and I think to a large extent because the officer himself, his perception was it was just a nervous habit. If his perception was, I told him, keep your hands out of your pockets, and he turned and put his hands in his pockets, I felt he was, you know, he didn't want me to be able to see what he was doing. I feared that he had a weapon. I think that's a different case. It's what he did. If he hadn't reached forward as if he were reaching under the seat, then they would not have had the authority to do a pat down and a protective car search.
Ms. Wellman, no. How would you write this opinion if you were to succeed? I mean, what would be the holding of the court that in a daytime, legitimate stop, if the officer detects, sees a furtive movement that could be either hiding or getting a weapon, the officer has reasonable suspicion for a Terry pat down. Is that what the state's position is?
No, I think that's too broad. I think Kyle's
teaches... No, that's why I asked the question.
I think Kyle's teaches us that we do have to look at the totality of the circumstances of this case.
Everybody keeps asking you, what are the totality of circumstances in this case, other than a usual stop with two officers not overwhelmed by the number of people in the car? Daytime, I don't find a high crime rate if in the area. I mean, what are the other circumstances other than the furtive movement, which I will grant you?
It is the furtive movement in the context that we know he knows it's the police that have stopped him because he's just been pulled over.
It's always going to be the case on a pullover, except if it's an unmarked car.
But right, it's not always the case.
Oh.
And the timing that he did it as soon as he was pulled over before the police were going to get to the window where he's likely to know they're going to come right up and see something. There's something he doesn't want them to see, and the risk is extremely high based on their experience. What are people likely to hide? Contraband, which wouldn't be enough, or weapons. No. And it's that in that context, and the context that for the car search, that of course he's going to be allowed to just drive away. We think that when the police see something that specific and describe it, now granted, I think the Court of Appeals, based on their use of quotation marks around the word furtive in their opinion, I think they were troubled by our continued use of the word furtive movement. And I understand that because that's conclusory. But where the police describe what they saw, him reaching as if he were reaching under the seat and why that created the concern, and they don't know any more about him, that dispels that. And he doesn't immediately say anything to them that dispels that. They know he didn't get the paperwork from there because the paperwork, whether he got it immediately or later, came from the glove box. Those circumstances are sufficient to warrant a reasonable person in that situation in believing that he may be in danger because the defendant may be armed or may have a weapon stashed in the car.
Ms. Wellman, why shouldn't we require the extra step of asking, what were you doing?
Well, for one thing, I think you would, I don't see why asking that question should be constitutionally required. And depending on what he says, you're putting the police in the position, does he have to accept what the defendant says? Suppose the defendant says, I was getting my false teeth because I had them in the glove compartment. I didn't want you to see me without my false teeth because, you know, it's embarrassing. I look ugly. The police don't have to believe what he says. The most expedient and least invasive thing for them to do in this situation is look where he reached. He reached under the car. That's all they did. They looked under there. They happened to find drugs, and that gave them then probable cause to arrest, and then they searched his person further and found the other drugs for which, and he was charged for that. If he hadn't been putting drugs under the seat, the search would have ended. Now, I realize that doesn't justify the search. We can't go backwards. But the point is, they didn't do anything any more invasive than the pat-down, outside clothing, and looking where he had reached.
But they didn't look where he had reached until after they started to pat him down.
They patted him down first. And Pennsylvania versus Mims says they can ask the driver and the passenger to get out for their, if they feel that that's best for their safety. Some police officers feel more safe if they have the people get out of the car. Some people prefer that they stay in the car. My impression, not being an officer, obviously, but from reading cases, none of them like it if the driver gets out of the car without being told to. But it's perfectly reasonable that if he was reaching for a weapon, it's right on him. They want to pat him down first and eliminate that if they can. Then they can look under where he reached. You know, they didn't look in the trunk. They didn't look in the glove box. They did what was responsive to what he did. And what he did was reach down as if we were reaching under the seat where he could have obtained a weapon. I think it's easy for us to fall into the trap of thinking, well, of course, police have to protect themselves. That's first and foremost for their safety. We want them to be safe. But we also want to protect the citizens from unwarranted seizures. We're not saying they can't do this. If they feel they need to protect themselves, we're only saying they can't use the evidence if they find it. That's wrong thinking. Terry versus Ohio teaches us when we say the search was unconstitutional, we're saying what you did was wrong. When we say it was constitutional, we're saying we're not going to make you take an unreasonable risk. And if we don't let the officers do a protective search in this situation, we are placing them at unreasonable risk.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wellman, and thank you, Ms. Hirsch, for the second argument today we had on the Fourth Amendment. The court is in recess until 1:30, and the students from Conemaugh High School may remain here, and Justice Robinsack will be out to speak with you. Everyone else is welcome to attend that session. We're in